No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I am joined by my co-host, Kathleen Gomez, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So please join in the discussion by calling in at 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008, or Skype us at BBS Radio 1. We have a special guest today because today is a special day. First and foremost, it is our one-year anniversary.
Yay! I can't believe it. We lasted a year.
I can't believe that Kathleen didn't send flowers on our anniversary or something like a nice little cactus, something prickly and scary that would remind me of you.
But I did you a bottle of tequila with the worm in the bottom so you can remember the old times. Yeah.
I know you bought the bottle of tequila, but it didn't make it to the post office, did it? So I'm waiting here to get something from Kathleen. But in the meantime, it is also Emancipation Day on Wednesday. Emancipation Day is our only holiday, official holiday here in the District of Columbia. And we're lucky today to have Ann Loykow to give us some background on Emancipation Day and talk about what it means to those of us here in Washington, D.C., who are fighting for equality. Before we get started, however, let me introduce my co-host, Kathleen Gomez, who is taking a break from doing her taxes and joining us from Arizona. I'm going to be especially nice to Kathleen today because I know she's expecting a big tax refund, and I know she wants to share it with me for all the wonderful things that I've done for her over the many years that I've known her. Hi, Kathleen.
You did not change my son. You had, five days?
I'm working on him. I can't make up for 21 years of child abuse in just a few days.
But hey, I trained him well. All the Republicans want him to work for them because I trained him when he was 6 or 7 in front of the city council of New York City, you know, fighting for bigger, smaller class sizes. And, you know, now he's like, he went to the dark side. So pray for America.
You were supposed to train him to be a Democrat, but you screwed up.
I think you're training him to be a Republican. Oh, gosh. Anyway, but no, thank you, Michael, Senator Brown. I can't believe it's been a year. And yeah. I think everyone out there who's, you know, sent us actually, you know, email saying that they enjoyed the show. We really appreciate it. And to all our friends and family who we definitely guilt tripped to listen to us. But they seem to enjoy it. And we want to thank them very much. Absolutely. We've got a lot of good friends.
And we have another person to thank before we get to Ann, and that is Cory Booker, the former mayor of my hometown, Newark, New Jersey, and the Democratic senator from the state of New Jersey, became a co-sponsor of the D.C. statehood bill, the new Columbia Admission Act this week. So that brings us up to 16 senators in the United States Senate and 66 representatives in the House of Representatives. So we're moving right along. Thank you, Senator Booker. I'm proud to be from Newark, New Jersey, and we're happy to have you with us. And that's the perfect segue.
I just want to say one thing about Senator Booker. I think the guy is such a from what I know, a decent guy, like really just a real approachable, and he's got a good sense of humor. And, you know, he did a really good, cool thing when he was, I think, the mayor of New York. He actually tried to live off of food stamps. I think it was $4 a week for most families, and he couldn't do it. A week, yeah, $4 or $4 a day. But I thought that was an incredible thing he did. So I liked him a lot.
And he took his picture. He took a selfie with Diego. When Diego
where McCain would not do it because he didn't do that kind of stuff. But there was Booker and Diego, and I thought, you know, that's pretty cool to have some kid say, hey, will you take a selfie with me, because they were together, and he did it. It's definitely a cool thing.
Well, that's how we roll in
that's
York.
That's how we roll. It's true. New York is cool.
If we're not stealing your cell phone, we're allowing you to take a picture with us. Right. But anyway, that's the perfect segue, not stealing your phone, but the perfect segue to Ann Loykow, the founder and president of Statehood Yes We Can, an organization in the thick of the fight for D.C. statehood. We're about to celebrate Emancipation Day, and many of us are going up on the Hill on Wednesday to lobby for the New Columbia Admission Act, see if we can get some more co-sponsors. There's parades. There's all sorts of activities. Ann was involved yesterday in a workshop to train people about statehood, and we'd like to welcome her to the show. Hi, Ann. How are you?
Hi. Thank you for asking me to come.
Yeah, well, thanks for being on. Can you explain to us a little bit what Emancipation Day is and why it's important to the people of the District of Columbia?
Okay, well, Emancipation Day, which is April 16th, is the sole holiday that's a local holiday in the District of Columbia. And what it commemorates was on April 16th in 1862, President Abraham Lincoln signed the D.C. District of Columbia Compensated Emancipation Act, which is the only Emancipation Act that allowed slaveholders to receive compensation, in this case up to $300 for each enslaved person. There were about 3,100 slaves living in D.C. In 1862. We also had a very large population of freed blacks that was larger than the number of slaves who were living in the district. The reason this act was the first federal Emancipation Act, and the reason it was is the reason that we're all fighting for statehood is that under the Constitution, Article 2, Section 8, I think it's paragraph 17, Congress has exclusive legislation authority over the District of Columbia, which means it can do anything. And so it was the one place where Congress had clear authority to free the slaves. There were a number of Emancipation Acts, but they all started getting tied to the issue of military necessity, so that there would be a legal basis for Congress and the president to pass them. And this act was passed something like 9 months before the Emancipation Act that we all learned about in school, which was January 1st, 1863, which freed the slaves in the territories that were in rebellion, which would be the Confederacy. And so this is significant in that it was the first one. It freed the slaves in the District of Columbia. And for those of us who live in the District of Columbia, the reason we made it our public holiday is because we want to be emancipated and become a state so that we have the same rights as every other American in the United States.
Well, and we should point out that at first, this was a really big deal. I mean, there used to be a big parade. We're going to have a parade on Wednesday. We've kind of revived that. But there used to be a big parade where people would go to the White House and the president would show up. And then it kind of fell into submission for many years and wasn't really heralded by the people of the district. But a woman named Loretta Carter Hayes kept it alive and she brought it back. And she kept all the records. She kept it fresh on everybody's mind. And several years ago, a councilman named Vincent Orange revived Emancipation Day, and now it's become a big celebration in the district. Schools are closed, government offices are closed, and we started to make a big deal about it again.
Let me ask you both a question. I had always heard Emancipation Day on April the 16th, But I thought it referred to taxes. So is there any correlation?
No.
Because, no? So it's
no.
two separate.
No, because there was no income tax in 1862.
Because I don't know why some, you know, I don't know if you've heard about that, but in the past years they talked about, I guess people who were, didn't want to pay their taxes were trying to claim it as Emancipation Day, not to pay taxes. But, you know, that's the day that you pay federal taxes and you know, all your taxes to your state or your whatever is property. To, I don't know how it works, but it seems you guys could tie those two things together because...
Well, it's the day after tax day, and we do tie them together.
Well, isn't that the 16th? Isn't that tax day?
No, 15th.
Oh, the
April 15th is tax
day. I'm glad
day.
I found that out because otherwise
oh,
I'd be a day late.
God.
Oh,
yeah,
my
be,
gosh.
You'd be penalized, right.
Thank okay. you.
But we do tie the two of them together because we pay the highest per capita income taxes in America. So it's particularly annoying for me. I'm sure that Ann agrees with this, but it's particularly annoying to pay all that money and then not have a voting member in either house of Congress. And in fact, I don't want to digress here. I want to stay on Emancipation Day, but the week before last, the United Nations admonished the United States for not giving full representation in both houses of Congress to the district. So we're moving ahead and we're getting more co-sponsors. We're getting more visibility for the issue worldwide. And Emancipation Day is just one more way to say to the world, hey, look, this is the place where the slaves were first emancipated. And yet here we are, the last jurisdiction in America to be freed.
And I just wanted to add, it's not just having voting representation in Congress. There have been numerous colonies throughout history who have had voting representatives in the Parliament or a General National Assembly of their country. Algeria and the French National Assembly is a good example. But they were still colonies. What we don't have is that we don't have statehood is we don't have state and local sovereignty, which means Congress is both our unelected state legislature as well as federal legislature, which means there is no balance of powers, and they can do anything they want to us. So we
That's
really
true.
Need emancipating.
That's true. I've seen them
because
do things,
things
you guys.
Happen to us that they wouldn't dare do to any other state or their own constituents.
Absolutely.
Well, and you know, that's important, Ann. I was going to ask you recently a bunch of misguided Washingtonians went back to New Hampshire for the third time and got the legislature to pass a resolution in support of D.C. voting rights. And I know that you wrote an eloquent letter to the Concord, the paper and news in Concord.
The Concord
criticizing, yes, criticizing what they had done. And so why did you do that? It could be good, you know, because on the surface, it seems like voting rights would be a good thing, but it's problematic. Can you explain to us why it's so problematic to have voting rights as opposed
okay.
to state?
Everybody mixes up the civil rights movement that happened in the 60s, and we're just celebrating the 50th anniversary of the 64 Civil Rights Act, and then next year will be the 1965 Voting Rights Act and the whole issue of voter suppression in the states. But what is the difference with the District of Columbia is in the 50 states, everybody has the right to vote. It's the question about whether there are roadblocks put in front of them exercising that, or whether they are harassed or intimidated from exercising it. In the case of the District of Columbia, because we are a colony, effectively, we do not have the right to self-government. So we do not have the right to have the offices to vote for that matter. And the only offices that we have to vote for are ones that are in a piece of legislation called which we call colloquially our Home Rule Act, where Congress basically gave a temporary delegation of authority to officials that we elect locally. But Congress, unlike in the states, at any time can repeal that act, change it, do whatever they want to, and for 100 years of our 214-year history, they effectively did that and we were ruled by three presidentially appointed commissioners.
Well, let me ask you this question, and I ask this of Senator Brown and the people that come on. I mean, I don't understand why Washingtonians aren't more involved actively, like protesting, and I mean, with all kinds of social media at your advantage, and you know, we see what happens in the rest of the world. And I mean, we're not really asking much. You guys aren't asking much. But when you hear how much your property taxes are and how the percentage of people from D.C. that go and serve on jury duties and go fight in wars, why isn't the Washingtonians demanding and being more active?
Well, there are a lot of us who are. But part of the issue is, number one, we've had been in this state for so long that people are kind of beaten down, the ones who've been here a long time and understand it. And so you get a sort of colonial mentality that you say, how can we change this? But people have been fighting from the beginning in 1801 and protesting and petitioning Congress and doing everything they could to get emancipation and get full rights. Mike mentioned the New Hampshire, in the letter that I wrote to Concord Monitor, one of the things I pointed out to them, that New Hampshire Senator Jacob Gallagher in 1902 was one of the first members of Congress to actually propose statehood for the District of Columbia, along with statehood for Arizona, New Mexico, and Oklahoma, showing back where we were. And that New Hampshireites back then knew the difference between statehood and just being a federal district who's ruled by Congress. The other thing is we have, to some extent, a portion of people who are fairly new to the district, and then we have a lot of people. You divide the population between those who come here before the federal government and stay over, and they're interested in federal issues. And for the most part, a lot of them who actually tend to be Republicans, vote in another state. They keep their state citizenship from the state where they came from. And they may either own a second house there, or their parents live there, or whatever. And there are a ton of people, and particularly the more prominent people in the district, who were in that situation. The people who care about local government and use local government services more have always been the lower class, the middle class, who've been pushing for home rule and been pushing for statehood. And so you have a kind of dichotomy of who the people here, and because we're relatively small geographically, it is not that difficult for people to have connections to surrounding states and be able to claim state citizenship there, even though they've lived basically all their lives in the District of Columbia.
I would add to that, and that's true. I mean, people even brag about it. There are people like Ralph Nader who brag that he's been voting in Connecticut for the past 35 years or something, even though he's a resident of the District of Columbia. But I would also add to that, because that's a good question, Kathleen. It's always troubled me why we can't get more people out at rallies and things like that. And I would add to the things that Ann said, even though there have been people who have fought this really from day one, a lot of people don't understand the impact this has on their lives. And you know, part of our struggle, I think, here in Washington is that we have to connect the dots for people. For example, they don't understand that we lose $2 billion a year in revenue because we can't tax income at its source. And that's a lot. I mean, it's a lot
of money.
It's 20% of our budget. And we lose it every year because, you know, you worked in New Jersey, lived in New York. You know, if you live in one state and you work in another, you pay a tax. Well, we don't have that here. And the worst thing about that for the District of Columbia is that 70% of the people that work in the city live outside the city. So that's just an amazing drain on the resources of the district.
And you know, I hate to say this, but you know, statehood, and it seems like your whole issue has so much history, and it goes back so far. And quite frankly, nobody knows history anymore. And I don't think there's an appreciation for, or they've forgotten the appreciation they should have for having these freedoms and the fact you don't have them yet. So, you know, it's so frustrating to me because look at, you know, you saw the poll they did where they asked people where the Ukraine was, and you know, people had no clue. So our problem is that we don't have a real, I mean, Washington may be a little bit different, that you have a lot of kind of educated people, but I think they still have the problem of really understanding what you lose and what you have to gain by becoming a state.
Well, I think you're right that there's a lack of history, and in the District of Columbia, there's a lack of understanding of district history. Like at the meeting I was at yesterday, people said our first elected mayor was Walter Washington. And no, that's not true. You know, when the district was created, we had two colonially chartered cities, Georgetown and Alexandria, who had elected governors and had colonial charters. And the new city of Washington, Congress chartered. And then there was two counties that were involved, one which is now Arlington County in Virginia, and the other was called the County of Washington. But they all had varying forms of government, some elected officials, some appointed, and over the years changed and went back and forth. And we even, right after the Civil War, during Reconstruction, had a territorial government. We have had kind of every conceivable version of government you can think of. And even for the period after the Revolutionary War until 1801, when we were still part of Maryland, we had people who were living in what is now the District of Columbia being elected to Congress. And we had full rights, which we lost when, and it was during a lame duck period right after Jefferson was elected. And they had, I don't know, 4 or 5 months between, I guess, between November and they weren't inaugurated until March. And the Federalists were trying to keep the Jeffersonians from taking over a lot of power, and so they wanted to change how the district was governed, and they passed an act that basically took away all the rights of the people. It was called the Organic Act of 1801. And it was one of those funny little, you know, congressional things that have to do with the fight between parties. And if you go back and basically remember the big change,
ask you. I mean, listening to the history, and it kind of is at the heart of where it all started, you know, Washington area. Is there any good book or anything that you know of, either one of you all? I was thinking of that because it just seems like it'd be fascinating to read the whole, when the issue started, going back.
There
are several good books. The best one I've read recently is one by a professor from Northwestern University by the name of Kate Mazur, and it's called An Example for All the Land, Emancipation and the Struggle over Equality in Washington, D.C. And she's one of the nation's foremost historians on Reconstruction. And what's fascinating about it is during the Reconstruction period, 1865 to basically 1874, you had a Congress was the Republicans for the most part, because the South was under military occupation, the old Confederacy, and it was only gradually towards the middle of the 1870s that the states were readmitted to the Union and the old Confederates were pardoned and allowed to run for office, etc. So the radical Republicans who controlled Congress were using the District of Columbia as a laboratory to figure out how do we integrate into our political system all these freed slaves. And in addition, the freedmen who had more rights, sort of, before, and make all that work. And what she describes is amazing stuff that was happening in the District of Columbia. And for someone my age, I'm 65, who was very active during the 60s and 70s in the Civil Rights Movement, all of the major issues and fights that we worked on in the 60s and 70s that are represented by the 64 Civil Rights Act and the voting rights and everything, were all fought in the District of Columbia and were basically framed what the issues were in the District of Columbia. And people in the District of Columbia actually won a whole lot of them. Like, for example, they got a public accommodations law, which we didn't get nationally until the 64 Civil Rights Act. We had the U.S. colored troops who came back, and a lot of them stayed in the District of Columbia because it had always been fairly hospitable to even during slavery to free blacks, and they wouldn't put up with stuff, and so they got the streetcars desegregated. We got one of the first school systems for African Americans. And we even had a couple of integrated schools, and the debates went back and forth which way to go on all of that stuff. So it was an absolutely fascinating period, and she explains a lot of the history. And as and when I read it, I said, this is all the history that those of us who live here, much less the rest of the country, do not know.
Right.
And it was interesting that a lot of the women suffragists, like Elizabeth Cady Stanton and others from New York, came to the District of Columbia to find out how to fight these battles from the people here who were doing them locally.
Wow, that's very impressive.
Well, you know, I think two things that are interesting, too, is that unfortunately the comment that Anne made about people not understanding the history in this teaching that she was in yesterday, most of these people were D.C. residents. A few of them had just come to D.C., but a lot of them had been here for years, and we just don't teach it, which is part of the problem. You know, we think Walter Washington was the first mayor because he's the first mayor we remember. And we just don't teach the history in our schools, and we need to do that. And another thing is that Mazur's book, in my humble opinion, ought to be required reading for every Republican on Capitol Hill, because a lot of these things that Anne just described to you were not only did Republicans participate in making them happen, but in many cases they pushed those changes. And boy, the Republican Party has gone a long way in the opposite direction these days. But you know what, Anne, we seem to be on a roll right now. In the last month, for example, we've gotten three new senators as co-sponsors of the D.C. statehood bill. And I'd really be interested in what your opinion is on how we keep this momentum going. You know, it seems that we're getting a little momentum now. There have been several articles in the newspaper. The UN spoke out, even though it didn't endorse statehood. It certainly endorsed, did not endorse the system that we have now. So we're moving in kind of a positive direction. How do we keep that momentum going?
Well, I think precisely by what we're doing right now. The biggest issue is the American people, including, do not know what the status of the District of Columbia is. They assume that all Americans have the same rights that they have. And they're kind of shocked when you try to describe that they don't, or they think that really nobody lives here. They're just a bunch of bureaucrats and they go home to Maryland and Virginia, you know, at the end of the day. And when you start explaining to them the long history and the kinds of things that happened to us, and this is what you were talking about earlier, what is the cost to people living here of not having state citizenship? And it's everything from the financial, which includes our tax base, or the fact that our bond rates are higher because our budget is treated as if it were a budget of a federal agency and has to be approved by Congress line by line, and they can do whatever they want to. And since Congress has not been very good at passing any kind of budgets in the last, 5 or 10 years, we often get hung up, and if they decide to shut down the government, they can shut down the district government. Because the same laws, like the Anti-Deficiency Act, which make it a criminal to spend money that's not been properly appropriated by Congress, apply to us as apply to the federal government and its agencies and officials. But it's other things. Congress puts all these riders. D.C., one of the things it's sort of notorious for is we have the highest HIV/AIDS infection rate in the country and have always had that. And it's at, you know, officially at the level that the Centers for Disease Control consider epidemic rates. And the reason, in large part, is Congress, because for a decade they prohibited us from doing needle exchange to try to cut down the spread when it was just taking off, which were things every jurisdiction and state and locality and the rest of the country could do to do good public health measures. We fight every year the whole issue of whether we can spend local funds for women's reproductive rights and abortions and for poor women in the District of Columbia, and we keep getting prohibited. And all these national organizations that come in to fight for you know, women's rights don't, for some reason, are not making the connection to our lack of rights generally, because we're not a state in the fact that they have to fight this every single year. We're the only jurisdiction in the country that I've heard of where Congress has actually prohibited a locality who had an election from counting the ballots on that election, and that happened in 1998.
Yeah,
on our initiative on medical marijuana, which we had to go to federal court and take a couple of years to get the right to actually count the ballots.
And understand what she's saying here. We had to go to court just to find out what the ballot count was, not to fight any other legal issue, but just to, through the Freedom of Information Act, to find out how the ballot went.
You mean like how many people voted?
Yeah.
Yes.
How many people voted in favor?
You could. They wouldn't give you the numbers for anything?
They wouldn't. There was something called the Barr Amendment. Representative Barr from Georgia prohibited the Board of Elections from spending any money on this particular initiative. And what happened was that was passed by Congress just weeks before the election. So the ballots were already printed and people voted, but they couldn't count that part of the ballot.
Is that amazing?
That's amazing. You know, anywhere else, it would be national news. I mean, it would be just a huge deal.
Yeah, and you know, we're fighting today over budget autonomy. There was a budget autonomy referendum that was passed by the people of District of Columbia, but many people, including myself, believe this is a violation of the Home Rule Act. We're also upset that we're wasting so much time trying to get autonomy for our budget, which, you know, is something we surely need. There's nothing wrong with having budget autonomy, and there's nothing wrong with having legal autonomy. But what we really need is statehood. So it bothers a lot of us that are activists that we're putting so much effort into something that we feel is just not going to happen. The GAO just did a study of the legislation agreeing that it violates the Home Rule Act. So we'll see if that ever happens, if we ever actually get autonomy over our budget.
But to put it another way, anything Congress passes regarding the District of Columbia, with the exception of statehood, Congress, because it has exclusive legislation authority under the Constitution, can change, amend, revoke for any reason they want. So they can give today and take away tomorrow. And that would, whether it's budget autonomy or anything else. But if you're a state, they do not have control over your state budget, your state taxes, how all the different powers that states have. And, for example, when you look at the 10th Amendment of the Constitution, which basically says that all those the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution nor prohibited by it to the states are reserved for the states respectively or the people, it doesn't apply to us. I mean, for example, we were one of the first jurisdictions to do domestic partnerships, and Congress basically said we couldn't implement it. We did do marriage equality, but by then the national tenor had changed on these things. But Congress could still say, even though the courts are holding all over the place, so they could say in the District of Columbia, you can not have that, and we're going to repeal that law.
Right. Let me ask you one thing. I'm sorry, Senator Brown,
go ahead.
One thing I always hear is that, well, you know, that would just be an automatic Democratic senator or a Democratic, you know, congressperson also. So, you know, it's going to tilt the balance of power or whatever. But don't you think that if Washington, D.C. became a state and had all the rights that other states had, don't you think Republicans would want to run too? Because, you know, it could go Republican. I mean, I don't know if it could, but I think that it would be an incentive for the Republican Party to become more organized and people to be able to vote in Washington.
If I could respond to that, I think that people look at the politics of a colony and think that's what it's going to be when it's a state, and they don't understand how distorted our politics are. As I'd mentioned earlier, there are all these people who live here but don't vote here, many of whom are Republicans. So the Republican Party is under-registered in the District of Columbia. Secondly, because we have a closed primary system, if you want to, if you care about local issues and you want to vote in the local Democratic primary, that often decides who's going to ultimately get elected, then you register as a Democrat, regardless of what party you are.
Right.
And if you were a state and you had a full political system, then the people who would be running would be a much different group. Because those, when you're running now, you're basically saying, I can put up with being dissed by everybody, in particularly Congress, and treated as less than a full American. I mean, it's routine that the congressional committees do not let the mayor or let our non-voting delegate testify on things that just apply to us or deal with laws applying just to the District of Columbia. And most self-respecting politicians wouldn't put up with that, so they don't run here. If we were a state,
exactly,
you would have all these people moving here to get involved.
Oh, yeah.
The politics would be wide open, and if the registration, I think, would be different. We're one of the fastest growing state level jurisdictions in the country, and have been for 4 or 5 years now, mainly fairly young people, a number of whom haven't registered as DC voters yet, and who knows how, you know, they would register. The only thing you can say is because we're urban, we would probably be fairly progressive or liberal,
right,
compared to more rural parts of the country. But we would probably be one of the most representative states in the country, because that's where the American people live, is in cities or nearby suburbs.
Well, I just like to make 2 points, too. I want everybody to understand that with statehood, we come in on an equal footing. So statehood is instant equality. We are the same as every other state, and that's important to understand in terms of our rights. And also, the point that you bring up, Kathleen, has been in every statehood battle. I mean, they said that Alaska and Hawaii, now you'll love this because you've been in, you know what mm-hmm. the makeup of Alaska and Hawaii is, but they argued that Alaska would always be Democrats and Hawaii would always be Republicans if we let them in the states. And we understand that, you know, there's one Democrat from Alaska these days, and I can't remember the last time we elected a Republican from Hawaii. So those things change over time. And I'd like to announce on the air tonight that I've signed an agreement with Diego Vlasic to be the chairman of Republicans for Diego. As soon as we become a state, he's going to be the first conservative United States senator from the District of Columbia.
Well, they do that. You will. It's kind of funny to say the University of Arizona young Republicans support statehood. So you know, that's good.
There you go.
There are
Republicans out there that support us. And I want to ask you, before we let you go in, I want to ask you one last question. We're about to elect a new mayor. So as far as statehood goes, thus far in the primary elections, we just had our primary on April 1st. Statehood hasn't played a very big role, in my opinion. We've tried to inject it into the discussion. I know that you have done that. And I certainly have done it in others. But what can we do to make our new mayor, whoever that person may be, a statehood mayor? Any ideas?
Well, I think we have a number of months now, and every forum and every time we see these people, that should be the first question that they're asked. And they should start, we should start educating them even more about what the advantages are to them, you know, in running for office here. I mean, like, for example, both of the two candidates who are the most prominent at the moment for mayor are both on the council now. And our council is the only council in the country that has to pass virtually every law at least 3 times, because nothing
right.
is permanent until Congress has said, we're not going to mess with it. So they pass it as an emergency measure. They pass it as a temporary measure, which is good for, I think emergencies are like 90 days and temporary for 180 days, and then they pass it as a permanent and hope it gets through, and it may be, you know, it takes forever until it passes all the congressional layover period. I mean, you think about all the paperwork and bureaucracy that we have to go through to do the simplest things because we're not a state. And the more people understand that and the more people start speaking out and the more educated they are, the more pressure it is on the people who are running for office. And I also wanted to point out a bunch of us who were active Democrats went to the Democratic National Committee's winter meeting and got a lot of the special interest caucuses in the party to endorse statehood. And virtually everybody you talked to when you introduced yourself as from the District of Columbia said, oh, you're the guys who want statehood. So I think the word is getting out more than people realize, because we've been working at it for quite a while now. And it's beginning to coalesce, so it'll be interesting to see how we do on getting more co-sponsors and getting more interest on Capitol Hill to right this two-century-old wrong.
Well, you know, it's funny. It's interesting that you bring up what a bureaucratic mess it is to have to pass legislation over and over again, because the legislative autonomy bill that's on Capitol Hill right now is entitled something like the District of Columbia Paper Reduction Act, because there's so much of it's such a bureaucratic mess. So you're absolutely right. This is just a ridiculous anachronism. It affects 643,000 loyal American citizens.
More than that, probably.
Right. That was the last figure we had. And we're getting about 1,200 people a month in the district. So that was a few months ago. We're probably up more around 645,000.
The numbers the Census Bureau puts out are as of July 1st. So you've got about 9 months, so you're somewhere around 655,000.
Well, you know, Ann Loykow has been one of the stalwarts in this movement, who's always there and is always up front. So I want to thank you for everything you've done, Ann. Tell people how they can get a hold of your organization and get more information.
Well, if you want to get more information, just go to dcstatehoodyeswecan.org on the internet, and you'll find tons of stuff and links to all sorts of things, and just start learning some of our history and the things people have done. Right at the top of the website is a timeline of D.C. history and our fight for our rights, and just read it and kind of weep that the United States treated some of its citizens the way we've been treated.
Well, I think it's fascinating. And I would say one more thing. I would say to every resident in D.C., if your city council person does not support paying the office of the shadow senator and shadow representatives, then you shouldn't vote for that city council, because that should be one of your biggest issues in the next 2 or 3 years is statehood.
We're trying to make it that way, and certainly Ann has been, again, very supportive on that front. She's testified on our behalf, and you're right. The office, we shouldn't have these offices if we're not going to pay for them, we're not going to fund them, and we're not going to support them. But, again, Ann's also been very helpful in that. So thank you so much, Ann, for being on the show tonight, and I look forward to talking to you again in the near future. And right now, we're going to take a short break, and so Kathleen and I can get our thoughts together, and there's a couple of other things we want to close out the show with, but I hope everybody out there in the listening audience, again, thank you, Ann. I hope everybody out there in the listening audience that's around Washington shows up for the Emancipation Day Parade, 10 a.m. on Pennsylvania Avenue on Wednesday, as we celebrate Emancipation Day. Now we're going to take a short break, and here's a song for all our regular listeners. This show has been focused on being a collaboration, and today is our one-year anniversary. So this goes out to Don, Doug, Deborah, Diego, Patty, Bonnie, Ann Loykow, and all our regular listeners and loyal followers. We'll be back in a few minutes.
What would you think if I sang out a tune? Would you stand up and walk?
and I'll sing you a song, and I'll try not to sing out of key.
We're back, and Kathleen has still not sent me any flowers. We've been checking on a regular basis. We called the florist. They said she tried to do it, but her check bounced. So
no, it was the mailman. The mailman forgot to come by and pick up my package to send to you. So it'll be coming tomorrow, and it'll be a nice little surprise. But I do want to thank you for the opportunity because – you know, when you asked me to do this, I was like, I thought we would just like, I mean, we still have our argumentative points and stuff, but I didn't really think it would be as much fun as it is. And it's gone by so quick, and I can't believe that, you know, but maybe for one or two that we've missed and the other one has held it up. But it has just been a lot of fun. And I don't know, in a small way, maybe with that little extra energy that hits that critical mass that gets this ball rolling so that you guys can be free.
Yeah, well, you know, I've got to say to you, too, that when I came up with this idea, I said to myself, you know, I said to myself, this is going to be boring. This is going to be boring to listen to me prattle on. Even my family shuts me out, you know? I mean, I start to talk, and, you know, after a while, they're like, what? Who are you? And so I thought, well, I need to find somebody that's interesting and fun to talk to, but also somebody that I trust, that I know, and who I know, regardless of what they say, even if they want automatic weapons around the house, you know, no matter what they say, that it's honest and it comes from your heart. And Kathleen Gomez, of all my friends in the world, you have one of the biggest hearts of anybody I've ever met. I've always known you to speak your mind. So if this show is true, and I hope it is, I mean, I think we try to make it that way.
Yes.
A lot of the accomplishment of that, a lot of the praise for making it an honest show should go to you, and I very much appreciate all your effort. And you know what?
Recorded. I love it. It's recorded, right? Yeah. I got it on record.
Don't think this gets you off the hook for trashing me about my camel hair coat, which I still have. And if I go on a diet, and if I go on a dramatic diet, starting today, I may be able to get back into it someday. But with all that being said, we don't want to get too mushy on the air, but it has been a great year, and I thank you so much for being part of it.
Thank you.
You know, you're just a regular part of my life anyway. Mary's godmother
Diego's. I know it sounds real mushy, but I have to say one thing that, you know, I've been in DC politics for a long time, and you know, it kind of reminds me of Douglas politics, can be very corrupt. And I just want to say that you have always, and many times you have stood alone, but you've always done the right thing. And for a lot of time, you know, that was like, oh man, everyone did it the crooked way because that's the way the crooked way went. But you always stood up, and no matter what was said and no matter, you know, how they ostracized you because they knew you were somebody who was a man of character and merit, and there's not very many of them. And so I do, and you know, this is true, kind of in my heart, you are what a politician should be. So I have a lot of respect for you. I don't agree with you all the time, but I do think that you're one of the kind of guys that we need in D.C., and you need to be paid, and you need to be getting up there and voting for the people of D.C.
So, well, thanks.
And you're welcome.
I just want to add to that, I also have a very keen fashion sense. But moving on from that, I know that you wanted to talk about something that bothered you this week that you read about. military.
I was wrong. Yeah. I was wrong on that. I was thinking that it affected women who served in our military. But, you know, we have a lot of foreign aid that we send out in ways of, you know, food or helping with housing to refugees and stuff like that. And what I had been reading is that a coalition of pro-choice right groups and women's rights activists have been frustrated with President Obama because it's on the issue of providing abortions for women raped in armed conflicts overseas. And despite years of lobbying, the activists have failed to persuade Obama to issue an executive order stipulating the U.S. foreign aid, though prohibited by Congress from subsidizing abortions as a method of family planning, could be used to provide abortions for women raped in wars. And let me tell you, you know, my ex was from Croatia and was very close to that whole Bosnian, Croatian, Serbian war. And part of the defeat, the plan to defeat the Croatians used by the Serbians, were to rape their women. Because that is something that is just very, it's a stigma on the woman, even though she, you know, had no way to defend herself. Right. And as they were killing the men in the village, they raped the women. And so it's a very dramatic, it's a very, very hard issue because, you know, when you have that situation and such terror and fear, it's very hard to be able, you know. And then with the children. So it's a huge issue and morally and all that. So I was just interested if out there in the audience anyone had any kind of something they would like to add to it. I'm, you know, I can see how this would really make people crazy. You know, oh, we're going to pay for money overseas for abortions. But, you know, there are certain things that at least that woman should be able to have the right to decide. And if we're sending foreign aid, I would like some of that foreign aid to go for this issue. And, you know, I just say to people, you know, like the Republican lady, I wish I remember her name from California, who said it'd be so much better if politicians just took the politics out of the woman's uterus. Remember? Is that the way she said it?
Well, she said, for the Republican Party. And I agree, you know, and this just shows you what happens at the national level, you know, that these people are constantly pushing their agenda. Because as you know, I was arrested and I went to trial over a similar issue in the District of Columbia when they came to D.C. and they said we could not use our money, our local money, to pay for abortions for poor women. Now, they can't do this in any other state. In any state, they're not allowed to do this. There's a prohibition to using federal money to fund abortions, but there are no prohibitions against using local tax money because the federal government doesn't have control over that, except, as Ann Loykow points out, in Washington, D.C., where they have control over everything. So they came into us and they said, no, you can't use, regardless of the circumstances, regardless of it's rape or anything else, you can't use locally raised tax funds to fund poor women's abortions. So we sat in the street and we protested, and several of us went, got arrested, went to jail, went to trial. And so it's an issue that many of us supported here, a similar issue here in Washington. And I got to agree with you. I think that, you know, we do all sorts of things in military aid to civilians in war zones, and this ought to be one of them.
Right. And one other thing, not to digress so much from our serious subject, but I want to let everyone know there's a big, I guess it's a blight on limes in Mexico. So as the summer comes, I think, you know, a case of limes used to be 20 or 30. It's now 120. So run out there and buy limes for your margaritas or whatever you make, because it's never not going to be around for a while. I was surprised by this. Look, when I paid $5 for a lemonade made with limes, you know, well, and I was like shocked. And then they explained to me, and all of a sudden now it's, you know, you can't find limes in any of the Mexican places where they make margaritas because there's this huge blight. I guess it's a fungus.
All right. Well, I just want our listening audience to take note of this, that the things that concern me are equality, getting rights for people, protecting women's health rights. And what's important to Kathleen Gomez is that she's got the lime juice for her margaritas and she has something to stick in her Corona in the
hey,
summer.
Listen, so, I still believe you have to enjoy life. You have to take those things that make you happy and embrace them as you fight the good fight. So there you go. Otherwise you become boring and you hang out in camel hair coats.
That's true. You know, there has to be some more reward for being a good person. And if it's a margarita or a Corona, I'm all for that. But let me also say, before we end, I just want to get this in real quick because maybe people can think about it and call in next week. But I read this article that I couldn't believe that the IRS had gone in and they had seized a woman's Maryland tax return refund and her federal tax refund because her family received Social Security benefits and they thought that they had overpaid the family. Now, this was when she was 4 years old and she is now 42. 38 years later, they have seized her income tax return, and they don't even know if she was the one in the family that got the additional benefits. Could have been her mother or another sibling. They have no idea. All they know is that somebody from that family got more money than they were supposed to, so they seized her tax returns. And I just think that's crazy and outrageous. And if you think it is too, I think you should call in next week and say something about it. And
they
we'll
should
talk
seize
about it
those
more.
Guys' income taxes down on Wall Street, you know, and maybe the
yeah.
Coke drivers, something like that. Do that, you know, all these. Oh my God.
Yeah, those guys who don't pay any taxes.
Exactly. Thank you very much.
Yeah, it's just crazy. Well, I'm going to give because it's our year anniversary and because I also forgot to send flowers to Kathleen. I'm going to let her have the last word.
Oh,
and
my
tell
God.
Tell you, America, like I have any choice, and tell you, America, that we'll see you next week. Go ahead, Kathleen. It's all yours.
Gosh, I don't know what to say. You don't do this very often, but I just want to thank everyone out there for listening to our show and for all the good response we've had and for those people that have picked us up and are playing us on their public radio stations like Fall Rivers Church. Thank you so much for your support. And it's just been great working with my good friend Michael Brown. And the D.C. residents really have a good leader. They just need to open their eyes and see you. And I think you're going to lead them to the right direction.
Okay. So while you're out there paying $3 for a lime, yes. Make sure that you're toasting.
Go buy limes today. Do it
right.
today
because
the price
right.
is going up tomorrow.
Right. And you won't have anything for the swimming pool for the summertime.
That's right. We can't.
Right.
That just isn't good.
So
all right.
Thank
you.
America, and we'll see you next week.
Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.